This is going to be a whirlwind review of statistical mechanics. And if you're listening to the audio only, these are lectures 28, 29, and 30. And we'll start on the second page of lecture 28. So let me remind you, if you have a system, and the system can be anything, it can be as small as a single atom, it can be as large as a galaxy, it's whatever you define it to be. If you put the system in isolation, and on the page I have it surrounded by adiabatic walls represented by these red hatch marks, that means I don't let the system trade energy with its environment, and I don't let it exchange particles with its environment. It's completely isolated. A system like that is called a microcanonical ensemble. There are going to be three different ensembles. And in the microcanonical ensemble, every state that the system can take is equally likely. None of them are weighted. None of them are more probable than any others. All right, the next complication, here I have a system. Again, it can be anything you define, but then a much larger system called a reservoir. And the criterion is that the reservoir is so large that if you add energy to it or take energy away from the reservoir, the temperature of the reservoir does not change. So for example, the system could be a cup of coffee and the reservoir could be Lake Michigan. Well, the combination of the system plus the reservoir, that's microcanonical. So R plus S is surrounded by these red adiabatic walls. Again, the walls mean no heat exchange with the environment. Anything outside R and S is the environment, and no particle exchange. But between R and S, I do allow energy to get transferred back and forth. So this barrier between the system and the reservoir might be, for example, a conducting copper plate. And so energy can flow back and forth, but particles cannot. And an ensemble like that is called a canonical ensemble. And now I'd like to derive for you the Boltzmann weighting. So consider two single states of the system S, and I'll label them S1 and S2. And while the system is in, let's say, state S1, there is some multiplicity. That is, there are a lot of states of the reservoir corresponding to the system having state S1. And I will label the number of states in the reservoir when the system is in S1, I'll call that omega sub R, R for reservoir. And similarly, when the system is in state S2, the multiplicity of the states of the reservoir is omega sub R, and then parenthetically of S2. Okay, now I'm interested in the relative probability of finding the system in S2 to finding the system in S1. And because I'm taking the ratio of these two probabilities, I don't have to worry about any normalization factor that would be in front of the omegas. Okay, that'll cancel out from the numerator and denominator. And because the composite system, reservoir plus system, is microcanonical, every state is equally likely. And so if you want to know the ratio of the probabilities, I just have to count the number of states that the reservoir can be in when the system is in state S2, and then divide that by the number of states the reservoir can be in when the system is in state S1. And you might wonder, why are we only counting the states of the reservoir? Shouldn't we multiply omega sub R of S2 by, for example, the number of states of the system? And yes, you should, but the number of states of the system is 1. The system is in a single state, S2, in the numerator. And then in the denominator, I should multiply omega sub R of S1. For the reservoir, I should multiply that by the number of states of the system. But again, that's 1. The system is in state S1. So the omega, if you invented a notation like omega sub S for system, omega sub S would just be 1. Now, a little bit of mathematics. The exponential function is the inverse function of the natural logarithm. So if you take e to the natural log of omega, that's just omega. So I haven't done anything. No approximations. And in the denominator, do the same thing. Take the exponential of the natural logarithm of omega reservoir of S2. And now I use the definition that the logarithm of the number of states is the entropy up to a factor of Boltzmann's constant, K sub b. in a rational world, you would set case of B equal to 1, so you wouldn't have to carry that around everywhere. So now I have the ratio of two exponentials, and the ratio of two exponentials is the exponential of the difference between their arguments. And so the relative probability P when the system is in S2 divided by the probability P when the system is in S1 is the exponential of, well, there's a common factor of Boltzmann's constant, so I'll take that out. And then I get the entropy of the reservoir when the system is in state S2 minus the entropy of the reservoir when the system is in state S1. Now we use the first law applied to the reservoir. So this says the change in the internal energy of the reservoir is the temperature of the reservoir times an incremental change in the entropy of the reservoir minus the pressure, if the system happens to be a gas, times a little increment of volume of the reservoir. And if you include chemical work, you would multiply that by mu, which is the chemical potential, times an increment in the number of particles of the reservoir. But this is the canonical ensemble, and we're not allowing particle exchange, and so dN is exactly zero. The number of particles in the reservoir will not change, so its derivative is nothing. And what about this middle term? What about PdV? Well, this is small compared to the first term, so I'm going to keep the first term dU. I've solved the first law for the entropy. The dU term is large. The dV term is much smaller. You can convince yourself of that by looking at, for example, a hydrogen atom. And you can look at the volume of the hydrogen atom. Now, this is fuzzy and quantum mechanical, so you'll have to invent for yourself some kind of cutoff, maybe where the probability of the electron goes down by 1 over E or something like that. But look at the volume of the hydrogen atom when it's in its ground state, and then look at the volume of the hydrogen atom when it's in its first excited state, and that will give you an estimate of dV. And then for P, you can put in regular atmospheric pressure, and you'll see that the second term is much smaller than the first term. So the last term involving dN is exactly zero. The second term I'm going to ignore, and I'm just going to keep the first term dU. Now, again, because the reservoir plus the system is a microcanonical ensemble, I don't allow any energy exchange with the environment. So any change in the energy of the reservoir has to come from the system. So delta U for the reservoir is negative change of energy delta U for the system. And I don't need it here because I'm not allowing particle number to change, but in a little while, I am going to allow particle exchange between R and S, but R plus S is microcanonical, and R plus S in combination will not exchange any particles with the environment. And so if the number of particles in the reservoir changes, that must come from the system. So delta N sub reservoir is negative delta N for the system. Okay, but I don't need the second line just now. And what do I have? Using the expression above, I can integrate. So get rid of the D's on both sides. And the entropy of the reservoir when the system is in state S2 minus the entropy of the reservoir when the system is in state S1 is just 1 over the temperature of the reservoir times the internal energy of the reservoir when the system is in state S2 minus the internal energy of the reservoir when the system is in state S1. Now I use this expression, the changes in energy of the reservoir have to come from the system. And so I replace energy of the reservoir by energy of the system. And I could have called this U sub S for system, but I used a different symbol entirely. And so this is E, but again, it means internal energy of the system now when the system is in state S2. And over here, similarly, this is the internal energy of the system when the system is in state S1. Okay, so that the negative sign out in front is this negative sign here. Now again, look at the relative probabilities. This is the probability for the system being in state S2 compared to the probability of the system being in state S1. And instead of this expression involving the internal energies of the reservoir, I use the second expression for the internal energies of the system, And now undo what we did before. So here I have an exponential of a difference, and that's just the ratio of two exponentials. I'm using a shorthand notation. 1 over Boltzmann's constant times the absolute temperature is beta. And so the numerator is the exponential of negative beta E2, and the denominator is the exponential of negative beta E1. This factor, the exponential of the energy, negative the energy divided by KBT, this is called the Boltzmann factor or a Boltzmann weight. So what we just found is that the probabilities are proportional to this Boltzmann factor. Now we have to normalize them. Okay, up until now, we've been looking at relative probabilities where the normalization constant was canceling out. But now I want the absolute probabilities. And here I use unitarity. That's the fact that if you add up all the probabilities for the system being in any state whatsoever, you have to get 1. And so the denominator that normalizes the probability is just the sum over some dummy variable, I called it n here, sum over n of e to the minus beta times the nth energy level. This combination occurs so often that it has its own symbol and its own name. The symbol is z, and this is the partition function. So the absolute probability is the Boltzmann weight, e to the negative energy over kBT, and to normalize it properly, I divide by the partition function. Okay, now, if somebody just says the partition function without qualifying it with an adjective, they mean this one. And if you are going to discuss several, then you should call it the canonical partition function or the Boltzmann partition function or the Helmholtz partition function. So canonical is coming from canonical ensemble. This is the partition function that's used in that particular ensemble. The name Boltzmann for the partition function is coming from the Boltzmann factor or the Boltzmann weight up here. And why is it called the Helmholtz partition function? Well, because if you take this partition function z, take the natural log of it and multiply by negative kB times the absolute temperature, you get the Helmholtz free energy, which unfortunately has two symbols to add to the confusion. It's called F and A. And textbooks use both with equal frequency, so we can't really pick one. You should be aware of both. Okay, but that's the canonical partition function. All right, done. Now next, here is the third kind of ensemble. This is going to be called the grand canonical ensemble. And again, I have the reservoir and system forming a microcanonical ensemble. So there's this adiabatic wall that prevents heat flow and particle flow between the combination of R and S and the environment. But between R and S themselves, I do allow energy to flow, just as in the canonical ensemble a few minutes ago. But now this membrane is permeable, and I will also allow particle exchange between the system and the reservoir. So scroll back up to the first law, and we solve the first law again for the entropy of the reservoir. This first term is large, the du is large. I am still going to neglect the second term. This is tiny, but now I can't neglect the third term, the chemical potential times the change in particle number. That's going to be large. So I'm going to keep the first and the third term for this grand canonical ensemble. And without dragging you through all the steps, do exactly what we did before. Write the change in entropy using the first law. Switch from the reservoir parameters U to the system parameters E for the energy, and the system numbers of particles N1 and N2. Again, so everything in this box refers to the system and not the reservoir. And you can tell that's happened because of this negative sign out in front, the signs have changed. So I've just used these two expressions in green to relate reservoir changes to system changes. Okay, so now the relative probability of the system being in state 2 to the probability of being in state 1. Well, it almost looks like the Boltzmann weighting before, except there's this extra term in the square brackets now, in the numerator and in the denominator. So this is a different kind of weighting. When you allow particle exchange and you use the grand canonical ensemble, this is called the Gibbs weighting factor as opposed to the Boltzmann weighting factor. And again, if you're interested in relative probabilities, that's all you need. But if you want the absolute probabilities, you have to use unitarity again. The probability that the system is in any state whatsoever has to be one. And so it's clear what you should do. Take the numerator, which is the Gibbs factor, and in the denominator, sum over all the states. And to avoid confusion, instead of calling it Z, this is a different kind of partition function, I'll call it Q. Some textbooks call this calligraphic Z or script Z. My penmanship is not good enough to distinguish the block letter Z from a calligraphic C, so I gave it a different symbol entirely, and this is used in some textbooks, so this is Q. So Q is the sum over all the states of the exponential of negative beta, remember beta is 1 over kBT, and then times the energy of the state minus the chemical potential times the number of particles in the state. And just to add to the confusion, in addition to being called the grand canonical partition function, this is also called the Gibbs sum. Now you have to be careful because there is also a Gibbs partition function, which we are not using at all in this lecture. And the Gibbs partition function has that symbol, that calligraphic script curly Z, which I've tried to render here. You can see why I'm not going to use that in the notes. But this is defined differently. This is the sum over all the particle states, e to the negative beta. And then instead of the energy here, which you would have in the Boltzmann factor, this is the enthalpy. And the enthalpy is used in systems when the pressure is held constant, but we don't need that today. But this is called the Gibbs partition function because if you take the natural log of it, take the natural log of curly script Z and multiply by negative kBT, you get the Gibbs free energy, G. So just as a reminder, if we can scroll up a little bit, if you take the natural log of the canonical partition function Z and multiply it by negative kBT, you get the Helmholtz free energy, F or A. And now we have a new partition function. We have a grand canonical partition function Q. If you take the natural log of that and multiply by negative kBT, you get yet another potential. And this is called the grand potential or the Landau potential or sometimes the thermodynamic potential as if there were no others, but don't call it that. That's very confusing to your listener or your reader. And it has symbol, Greek letter capital phi. It also in some textbooks has symbol Greek letter capital omega. Again, don't call it that because we're using capital omega for the multiplicity and they are not the same thing. Okay, so that's a tour of the thermodynamic potentials. There are many thermodynamic potentials. Just to name them so you can see the set. The internal energy U or E is one of the thermodynamic potentials. The enthalpy H is another one. The Gibbs free energy, the Helmholtz free energy, and the Landau potential. And there are even more, but they're not used as frequently. All right, so all of those are thermodynamic potentials. They're all measured in energy units in the MK system. They're all measured in joules. Okay, moving on to lecture 29 now. And then the first note on the page says CF lecture 11. So I only need one equation from lecture 11 of the StatMech course. And that's this. What I'm trying to do is extremize the entropy S, but subject to constraints. And so really you could maximize omega, you could maximize the multiplicity, just the number of states, but that's inconvenient to do because it involves products. And so I can take any monotonically increasing function. It doesn't have to be natural logarithm, but there are some advantages to choosing natural log. And here's a graph that shows you that natural log is monotonically increasing. So maximizing the log of the number of states is the same thing as maximizing the number of states. It's just more convenient to do it this way. However, there are some constraints. And so one of the constraints is unitarity. I'll build that in. The constraint is, in parentheses is written so that it's equal to zero. This says that if I sum up all the probabilities minus one, I will get nothing. So everything in parentheses is zero, and out in front, there's a Lagrange multiplier, lambda. Lambda will enforce that constraint. I also have another constraint. The average internal energy of the system is just the weighted sum of all the energies of the states, and the weighting factor is the probability. So if you multiply P for the ith state, probability of finding the system in the ith state, by the energy of the ith state, and then sum over I, these sum over all the microstates of the system, that sum will be U. And so I will specify U. I will tell you what the average energy of the system. So again, everything in parentheses is equal to zero. And there's a Lagrange multiplier, a different one, beta, out in front that enforces that second constraint. And now we need a third constraint and a third Lagrange multiplier. So I showed you these two already. Here's the first constraint, and it's Lagrange multiplier lambda. Lambda turns out to be related to the partition function z. So you can think of z as something that enforces the unitarity constraint. And then I have a second constraint with a second Lagrange multiplier. This Lagrange multiplier beta is 1 over kBT. So it's exactly what I was using as a shorthand before. And now I have a third constraint. This constraint enforces particle conservation. So this says if I sum up all the numbers of particles in every state, I'm using nu instead of n because there are too many n's floating around in the lecture. But nu is the number of particles in state I. If I sum up sum over I the number of particles in every state, I get the total number of particles, and that's n. If you're dealing with a system where the number of particles is conserved, like helium atoms, for example, you can't create and destroy helium atoms. They're conserved, and so the total number n will be fixed, and this constraint will be zero. There is a third Lagrange multiplier out in front. Now, you probably could have called that just mu by itself, but it's conventional to call it beta times mu. It's just another constant. And beta times mu will enforce the particle number conservation constraint. Okay, by the way, this mu is the chemical potential that I mentioned before. Mu is also the Gibbs free energy G divided by N, the number of particles. So mu is an intensive quantity. The Gibbs energy G is extensive. It will double if you double the size of the system, and the number of particles N is also clearly extensive. It will double as well. But the mu is the ratio of G divided by N, so that's intensive. That it doesn't matter how much, how big the system is, how many particles you give me. Okay, the grand canonical ensemble is also known as an open system, because the system can trade not only energy with a reservoir, but the system can trade particles with the reservoir. And so if you put these in thermal contact, then the energy will flow until what? Well, until the temperature of the reservoir equals the temperature of the system. And so after a long time, when this condition is reached, you say that the reservoir, the system, are in thermal equilibrium. They have the same absolute temperature. Similarly, if you give the system and the reservoir enough time to trade particles so that they stop doing that, eventually they will reach what is called diffusive equilibrium, and that's when the chemical potential of the reservoir is equal to the chemical potential of the system. Now, for our purposes, the system is going to be a single particle wave function. Remember, I said you can define the system to be anything. And now it's not even going to be a single atom, it's going to be a single state. And so if it were an atom like a hydrogen atom, the hydrogen atom has an infinite number of states that the electron can be found in. Any one of those can be singled out and called the system. The reservoir is going to be all the other states that the system can adopt. Now, this is a little strange because the system and the reservoir are neither spatially nor temporally separated. That is, I can't point to the system and say that's the system and point somewhere else and say that's the reservoir. They overlap. They are defined. Again, I need a specific example. So if you're dealing with the hydrogen atom, it might be that the ground state is the system and all of the higher excited states would be the reservoir. But for a given atom, which is in a superposition, you can't point anywhere and say that's the system and that's the reservoir. Okay, so aside from that complication, let's press on. Remember, we solved for an open system or for a grand canonical ensemble, we solved for the absolute probability, not just the relative probability. So in the numerator, there is this Gibbs weighting factor. And in the denominator, you need the grand canonical partition function, which we're calling Q. And now I want to evaluate this probability, and I want to find the average number of particles in a given state. This is called the occupancy for both fermions and bosons. So right now we're going to start quantum statistical mechanics. Let's do fermions first because they're easier. Because of the Pauli exclusion principle or the spin statistics theorem, if you have a fermion, you can have the state unoccupied, no fermions in the state, or exactly one fermion in the state, but that's it, not two, not three, not four. So your choices are zero or one. So remember, there's a sum in the Q. Let me scroll back and find it here. In the grand canonical partition function, there's a sum, but for us, for fermions, the sum only has two terms in it, namely n equals 1 or n equals 0. So if I plug in n equals 0 into this expression, e to the 0 is 1, and it doesn't matter, I'm computing Q, I'm finding Q. So the first term is 1 when n equals 0. If I plug in n equals 1, I just get e to the negative beta times the quantity epsilon minus mu. I'm using epsilon now for the energy, lowercase Greek letter epsilon instead of capital E to remind you that this is the energy for a single state. Okay, and that's it, period. Only two terms in this sum. So if you want to find the absolute probability, that is the normalized probability for finding no particles in the state, it is E to the zero in the numerator and then Q in the denominator. So that's e to the zero is the one over here in the numerator, and then this expression in the denominator, that's Q, that's all of Q, those two terms. The absolute probability of finding one particle in the state, well, I plug in n equals one into this expression in the numerator, so I get e to the negative beta times the quantity epsilon minus mu, and then in the bottom, that's the grand canonical partition function Q again. Now let's use those probabilities and we'll calculate the expectation value of the number of particles, or again, I told you this is called the occupancy of the state. So to find the average value of n, it's just the probability weighted sum. We're doing exactly what we did. Let me show you back in lecture 28. Or was it 11? It was 11. Here, this sum is the sum over the energies, but weighted by the probabilities. And when you do that, you get the average energy. So instead of calling it E inside angle brackets or E bar or some notation like that, the convention is to call that U. But that U is just the average of this energy E, probability weighted sum. So that's what I'm doing here, except for number of particles. So I take the number of particles in the ith state, and I multiply by the absolute probability that the system is in the ith state, and then sum over all the possible numbers n. But again, for fermions, there are only two. There's 0 and 1. Well, when you plug in n equals 0, that knocks that term out. So 0 times p0 is nothing, and 1 times p1 is just p1. And so this p1 is also the average occupancy. And all I've done to transform this expression in the box to this expression in the box, they're exactly equivalent. I just multiplied numerator and denominator by e to the plus beta times the quantity epsilon minus mu, just to clean it up a little bit, because here there are two factors of the exponential and down here there's only one factor. There's no other reason for doing that. You should familiarize yourself with this expression. It occurs quite often, and this is famous. This is called the Fermi-Dirac distribution. Note that there is a plus sign between the exponential and the one in the denominator, because shortly we're going to see this expression again, except with a minus sign for bosons. Okay, but before we do bosons, let's make a graph of this. So this is the occupation number, the average value of n, or the expectation value of n, plotted versus energy for this single particle state. And there's a special place where the behavior turns over, and that's when E is equal to mu. You can see something funny is going to happen when epsilon is equal to mu. So in that case, epsilon minus mu is 0, e to the 0 is 1, and the denominator just becomes 2. So 1 over 2 is a half. So when the epsilon is equal to mu, that's where the expectation value of n is a half. And there are two curves drawn here. The blue curve is for low absolute temperature for a cold system, and the red curve is for slightly higher absolute temperature. And you can see that the corners get rounded off. So I should have drawn one more curve. At absolute zero, this is a step function. At absolute zero, all the low energy states are occupied, and there's an abrupt transition. There's a jump discontinuity, and then for energies higher than mu, all the states are unoccupied. So the average n changes from 1 to 0 at mu. But for non-zero temperatures, all of the curves for any temperature will go through 1 half when epsilon is equal to mu. There's also a conservation going on here. So the area up here has to go somewhere when you heat the system, and those states wind up in this long exponential tail. So the area under the curves is the same in both cases. So any states that you take from here, you have to put into this long exponential tail. This goes all the way to infinity if the temperature is non-zero. Okay, that's it for fermions. Now let's take a look at bosons. For bosons, you can have any number of particles in the state, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to infinity. So again, I have to compute the expectation value, or the occupation number n. And here I changed the dummy variable because some student was confused in the past. They were asked, I had an n here originally, and they were asking, if you're summing over n, then when you're done, there is no n dependence, and so how can you possibly have an n on the left-hand side? And the answer is, this is just notation. Calling this expectation value of n is maybe not the best way to represent it. We should call it something else. But that's what everybody uses, so we're stuck with it. And I just changed the dummy variable to show them that that there really was no n dependence left over. So here I have to sum over, let's say, j, from j equals 0 to infinity, of the j out in front, and then weighted by the probability that the system is in the jth state. And here you can see I started at 1 instead of 0, because when you put in j equals 0, that term gets knocked out anyway. 0 times p0 is nothing, so you might as well start with 1 and go all the way to infinity. And now I have to evaluate this expression. So if I put in what we decided was the absolute probability for an open system, for the grand canonical ensemble, well, there's that familiar Gibbs weighting factor on the top, and there's the grand canonical partition function Q in the denominator. And the only difference is that there's a J in the sum on the top. The sum in the bottom is identical except for the number of particles. So the top sum has a J, and the bottom sum has an invisible factor of 1 in here. And again, I changed the dummy variable index. I'm using J for the top sum and K for the bottom sum. You could interchange them. You could call the top sum N and the bottom sum P if you want. It doesn't really matter. You shouldn't call them by the same letter, though. You'll get confused if you do that. All right. Now, I'll make a definition, because it's a little tedious to keep writing beta times the quantity epsilon minus mu over and over again. So I'll just call that R for ratio. And the top sum in the numerator becomes the sum over j of j times e to the negative jr. And now you realize, well, I could get that j from the exponent and bring it down in front if I just took a derivative. So here I have the sum with no j in front. There's just a 1 here, invisible 1 in the box. And sure enough, if I take the negative derivative with respect to r, of this exponential that will reproduce the exponential, but it'll bring the factor of j down in front. So you'll get exactly this expression. But now you realize that this thing in parentheses, well, that's just q. That's the same as this expression for q, except I changed the dummy variable from k to j. So the numerator is the negative derivative of q with respect to r, and the denominator is just q itself. But now I can evaluate both of them. The q sum is a sum over some dummy variable, let's call it k, of e to the negative kr. Maybe k was a bad choice. This has nothing to do with the Boltzmann constant, which is k sub b. This is just plain k. But the sum is a geometric series, and so you can sum it exactly, and it will sum to 1 over 1 minus e to the r. And that will converge if e to the negative r is less than 1, but it is. The exponential of a negative quantity is going to be necessarily less than 1. Okay, so this is what I have to evaluate. The expression for the expectation value of n is the following. First, there's a 1 over q. And if q is this, if q is 1 over 1 minus e to the negative r, then 1 over q is this, 1 minus e to the negative r. So that takes care of the denominator. And now the numerator is the negative derivative with respect to r of q, but q is 1 over 1 minus e to the negative r. And I just wrote it differently for no reason. Instead of 1 over something, I just wrote it as 1 minus e to the negative r, and I just raised that to the negative 1 power. Okay, so now we have to practice the chain rule a little bit. When you take this derivative, you'll bring down one factor of the exponential out in front, but that negative 1 times this negative sign cancel, and you get a plus. And then this factor of 1 over q is here. This is also 1 over q. And then when I took the derivative, I decrement the exponent by 1. So now I get this thing in parentheses, 1 minus e to the negative r, but raised to the negative 2 power. And are we done? No, not yet, because now you have to go inside the parentheses and take the derivative of both of these terms with respect to r. Well, the first one is easy. The derivative of 1 with respect to r is 0. And the derivative of negative e to the negative r with respect to r is just e to the negative r. Again, two more minus signs that cancel out. So just e to the negative r. And a little bit of algebra to clean it up. And the same trick that we used before, I'm going to multiply top and bottom by e to the plus r just to clean it up. And so the numerator just becomes 1. In the denominator, this term becomes e to the plus r. And the second term just becomes 1. So as promised, there is a short expression for the expectation value, but now for bosons. And if I put back what R was beta times the quantity epsilon minus mu. This is also famous. This is the Bose-Einstein distribution or expectation number. And it looks just like the Fermi-Dirac expression. Let me scroll up. Right? It looks just like this in green, the Fermi-Dirac expression, except instead of a plus sign between the exponential and the 1, now there's a negative sign. There is a related, well, actually two more related distributions. If you take the Bose-Einstein distribution and you set the chemical potential mu right there in the box equal to 0, you will get this expression. This is called the Planck distribution. This is used for photons. And so why would you ever do that? Why would you set mu equal to 0? Well, remember, going back to chapter 11 briefly, mu, or I know it's not chapter 11, it's the top of this page 29, mu or beta mu is the Lagrange multiplier that enforces the particle number constraint. And so if you have a system where the number of particles is conserved, you can't create and destroy particles at will, then the chemical potential mu must be non-zero. But for photons, you can create and destroy photons at will, as much as you like. Every time you turn on the light switch, you create quadrillions of photons. And so for the kind of particles that are not conserved, you have to set mu equal to zero. You don't want to enforce that number particle conservation constraint. And so you set mu equal to zero, and that gives rise to the Planck distribution. There is one more distribution. If this exponential is very large compared to the one in the denominator, then you can just forget about the one, and the distribution would just become one over e to the beta e, or in other words, e to the minus beta epsilon, and that is the Boltzmann distribution. So in the limit where the exponential gets very large, you're back to classical statistical mechanics, not quantum statistical mechanics. And that limit is the Boltzmann distribution. Okay, making progress. And now let's go on to lecture number 30. Here I have a graph of the different expectation numbers, the average ends for the different distributions in blue. This is the Fermi-Dirac distribution. It's at low energies, it's one, indicating that that state is filled. It's occupied by one fermion. And then as you increase the energy, depending on the temperature, it will go through 1/2 at some point. And that happens when epsilon is equal to mu. And then it will exponentially decay to zero for large epsilons. This is just telling you that it's very improbable that you'll find a fermion at a state with a very large energy. For bosons, I have the distributions rewritten here. For bosons, when epsilon is equal to mu, then this term in the box is equal to zero, and e to the zero is one, and one minus one in the denominator is zero. So one over zero blows up. So you can see as epsilon approaches mu from above, the curve gets higher and higher, and this green curve shoots off to infinity. In fact, it is not possible for the energy epsilon to be less than mu, because you'd have a negative number of particles in that case, and that doesn't make any physical sense. So this has an asymptote when epsilon is equal to mu. And then in black, this curve is the Boltzmann distribution. So the Boltzmann distribution for this, that describes classical, not quantum stat mech, kind of splits the difference, right, between the Fermi-Dirac and the Bose-Einstein distributions. Okay, the last topic for today is going to be the degenerate Fermi gas. Degenerate in this sense doesn't refer to any prurience of the electrons or whatever the system is. Degenerate in this case means cold. It means all the low states will be occupied and all the states at higher energy will be unoccupied. This applies to electrons in a white dwarf. That's a little surprising because white dwarfs are the cores of stars that have gone supernova, and the core temperature is millions of Kelvin. And yet that's still a cold Fermi gas, cold in this sense, degenerate Fermi gas. Metals at room temperature, like copper or sodium at room temperature, those are also examples of the degenerate Fermi gas. The gas refers to the free electrons that can wander around in the metal crystal. So think of the electrons as gas molecules bouncing around inside a box. And neutrons, which are also fermions, neutrons in a neutron star, are another example of degenerate Fermi gas. Also helium-3, there's a stable isotope of helium that has two protons, but only one neutron in the nucleus instead of two protons and two neutrons. Helium-3 is therefore a fermion, while helium-4 would be a boson. Okay, what is the test? How do you know if your Fermi gas is degenerate or not? I'll give you one test here, and then we'll talk about another one in a few slides. So let's look at 1 over lowercase n, and that is the volume of the system divided by the number of particles in the system. Both V and N are extensive quantities. The ratio is intensive. So this is 1 over the concentration. If that is very small compared to the quantum volume, okay, what's the quantum volume? The quantum volume is the cube of the de Broglie thermal wavelength. And that's just a shorthand for this collection of symbols. So this is Planck's constant without the bar, divided by the square root of 2 pi times the mass of the particle times Boltzmann's constant times the temperature. So this is temperature dependent. And everything in parentheses here is lambda. If you raise that to the third power, you get the quantum volume. So you should plug in numbers and see if they match what I've written here. For an electron in copper at room temperature is 300 Kelvin. If you plug in the mass of the electron in here for M and the fundamental constants H and K sub B, and you put in 300 Kelvin for T, you'll find that the quantum volume is 4.3 roughly nanometers cubed. And you should compare that to 1 over the concentration for electrons in copper, and that is only 0.2 nanometers cubed. So already 0.2 is a lot less than 4.3, and the inequality will get even larger when you cube these quantities. Okay, so this will become 0.008 something, and this will become 64 something. So definitely the double greater than sign is appropriate here. Okay, so that may be a little surprising. Room temperature electrons in copper are cold. You can consider 300 Kelvin to be essentially absolute zero, and you won't make too much of an error. Okay, now let's look at exactly zero Kelvin, because this case is easy. The next case we're going to consider, there are three more lectures we're going to look at where we take the temperature to be slightly above zero Kelvin, but you'll see that that's much more complicated. So let's look at the simple case, absolute zero, and I plot the expectation for the Fermi-Dirac distribution. So this is that step function that I mentioned before. For low energies, all the states are filled, and then there's a jump discontinuity, and the high energy states are empty. That transition occurs when epsilon is equal to the chemical potential mu. Now, this also happens to be the Fermi energy. If you start packing the states in here, eventually when you run out of states, when they stop, that energy at the highest level is called the Fermi energy. We learned that from the last lecture. But these two are equal. The chemical potential and the Fermi energy are equal, but only at absolute zero Kelvin. So next time when we talk about slightly higher temperatures, that won't be true. Okay, so just be aware of that. Now I'm going to take a three-dimensional box. I'm going to make all the dimensions equal. It's not necessary to do that. It's just, it won't matter if you put, if these were different at this, if these were length, width, and height. Eventually everything would be referred to the volume anyway, so you might as well take a shortcut and call everything L to begin with. I'm going to put free particle wave functions in the box. We learned how to do that last time. And the Ks, or the wavelengths, are quantized. So lambda X is twice the dimension of the box along the X direction, divided by some quantum number. And again, I changed the notation from last time. I think I called this N sub X, and now I'm calling it J sub X. J or N or whatever is just some integer, some quantum number. And the same for the Y direction and the Z direction. And now I want the associated momentum. So the de Broglie momentum associated with this particle is just Planck's constant, again, without the bar, divided by the wavelength, or Planck's constant with the bar times the wave number K. There's a factor of 2 pi between lambda and k. There's also the same factor of 2 pi between h and h bar. And if I plug in what lambda x is over here, I see that the momentum in the x direction is just Planck's constant times some integer divided by 2l. And then I need the momentum in the y direction and the momentum in the z direction. And you can see because I'm using the non-relativistic energy, so this would satisfy the Schrodinger equation, for example. The energy of the state is going to be p squared over 2m. That's a non-relativistic result. So if you consider relativistic particles like photons, which always travel at the speed of light, then this is inappropriate. And in particular, the mass of the photon is zero. So you definitely shouldn't use this expression. But for electrons, they are not, they turn out to be non-relativistic in a metal. And so the energy of the jth state, this notation here is J vector. That's a shortcut. Instead of writing JX, JY, JZ, I just wrote J vector. That energy is the momentum in the x direction squared plus the y direction squared plus the z direction squared. So that's the total momentum vector squared divided by twice the mass of the particle. And I plug in for the p's using the expressions above. Again, pull out the common factors, the h bar squared over 8ml squared. And then what you're left with is these quantum numbers, j in the x direction squared plus j for the y direction squared plus j for the z direction squared. And as a shortcut, I would just call that j vector squared. So just j vector is jx comma jy comma jz. And this is the j vector dotted into itself, j squared. Okay, now if you consider this is now reciprocal space, I could call it K space, but now it's J space. So these are just those integers that go into the de Broglie momentum definitions. In this kind of picture, this is supposed to be the first octant. This is a sphere that has been cut by the JX, JY, JZ planes. And so it's like taking an orange and cutting the orange in half, and then in half again, and then in half again. So this is an eighth of an orange. Everything happens in the first octant, where JX, JY, JZ are all positive. And the states of the system are represented by these tiny dots in here. But there are so many states that are so close together that they look like a continuum. And that will let me eventually move from a sum to an integral. The integral is a lot easier to evaluate. So just think of this as being filled with something like Avogadro's number of dots. So many dots that you can't tell that they're discrete, that it looks like a smeared out continuum. Okay, any point on the surface of this octant, so that would be like on the orange rind, the energy of a particle in a state like that will be the Fermi energy. This is the largest energy that the system can have. And so that's h bar squared over 8ml squared. And then the maximum value of this combination, which I call J max squared. And there is a constraint. The constraint is that the number of particles is n. That is to say, the number of dots in the first octant is n. And so that is 2. Where's the 2 coming from? Because we're treating electrons, and the electrons have a spin that can be up or down along a given direction, so 2 polarizations. This factor of 1/8 is coming because I'm looking at the first octant of this sphere. And then the volume of the sphere in J space is 4/3 pi times J max cubed. Okay, and then I canceled some factors of 2 to clean up the expression and write it this way. Well, that's N written in terms of J max. I can invert that and find J max as a function of N. And I can also find the Fermi energy. So once you know that J max is this, 3N over pi, all to the 1/3 power, I can go back up here and I can substitute that for J max and then square it. And so you'll get that the Fermi energy is H bar squared over 8ml squared. That's copied down here, H bar squared over 8ml squared. And then for J max squared, I take this expression and I square it. And so the exponent is 2/3 instead of 1/3. Okay, and then a little bit of algebra to clean things up. And as so I've taken the L, the dimension of this cubical crystal, and I brought it inside the parentheses. That lets me write it as L cubed. That's convenient because L cubed is V. And now you see I have the ratio of these two extensive quantities, N over V, which is the concentration, lowercase n, which is intensive. And so the Fermi energy is just given by this expression. And because that n, lowercase n, is intensive, again, it doesn't matter how much of the material you have. You can give me a cubic centimeter of copper, or you can give me a cubic meter of copper, for example, and that will have no effect on the Fermi energy. It'll be the same in both cases. Now I want to compute the average energy of the system. So I should really do this. There are, again, 2 polarizations for the electrons, spin up and spin down. I should sum all of the J quantum numbers, JX, JY, JZ, they're all going to go from a lower limit of 1 to J max, but I replace the 1 by 0. And again, if we scroll up, you can see why. Again, there are so many dots that are so close together, you can't really tell that the origin is not occupied. It doesn't make any sense for the quantum numbers to be 0, but they're so close to 0 that you can't tell. And so I just replaced the lower limit. Instead of calling that 1, I called it 0. And then the upper limit is the largest J max, where that's on the rind of the orange, where the energy is the Fermi energy, that J max. And again, because there are so many dots so close together, I replace these sums by integrals, and the integrals will start at 0, and they'll all go to J max. The energy inside is E sub J. We worked that out before, though. E sub J, if I can scroll up, is sitting right here. That's the expression I'm going to use for E sub J that I'll plug into the integral here. So that goes right there in the integrand. And then instead of summing, I integrate, and so there's a djx, djy, djz. The trick to evaluating this is, even though we started out in Cartesian coordinates and we looked at the first octant of the coordinate system, now you want to change from Cartesian to spherical coordinates. And so instead of looking at jx, jy, jz, now there will be spherical coordinates. There's a polar angle that I call theta sub j, and an azimuthal angle that I call phi sub j. The J subscript is to remind you that these are not in XYZ space, these are in J space. And I really should have called this R sub J, but everyone calls it J, so I did that as well. But if you want to think of the spherical coordinates as theta J, phi J, and RJ, then J is just RJ. I hope that wasn't too confusing. Okay, well, again, 2 for the 2 polarizations, spin up and spin down. Here, if I were integrating over an entire sphere, the integral over theta and phi would give me a factor of 4 pi, but I'm only looking at the first octant, so it's 1/8 of 4 pi, or in other words, pi over 2. And now I have this integral over j to evaluate. So let's see if we can identify where the terms came from. This expression in the box is the energy. That's Ej. H bar squared over 8ml squared j squared is the energy, and again, we had that already. That's this, h bar squared over 8ml squared times j squared is epsilon sub j. And then where did this j squared come from? That's part of the measure. In spherical coordinates, the measure is r squared sine theta dr d theta d phi, and so this is r squared. This is r sub j squared. So that's part of the spherical measure. Altogether, there are 4 factors of j. Here's the same expression, integrated over angle and cleaned up a bit, but this is an easy calculus 2 integral, so I just have to integrate j to the 4th dj from 0 to j max. You can do that in your sleep. And you wind up finding that the internal energy of the system is given by this expression, where j max is raised to the 5th power. But now we have to go back up on the top of the page and catch what J max is. J max is this. That's the particle number constraint. J max is 3n over pi to the 1/3 power. And so if I put that in for J max and raise it to the 5th power and do lots of algebra, what you find is inside this expression is exactly the Fermi energy that we had before. And so you find that the internal energy U is equal to 3/5 times the Fermi energy, but then times n, because the internal energy U is extensive and the Fermi energy I told you was intensive, and so there must be some extensive quantity to make U extensive, and that quantity is n. So 3/5 n e Fermi is the average energy of the system. Okay, now on the top of this page, this is the second test to see whether the system is degenerate. So to remind you, we'll scroll back up to the top. And we had one test here comparing 1 over the concentration to the quantum volume and making sure that 1 over n was a lot less than V quantum. That's one test for degeneracy. But because the V quantum has a temperature T in it. This is the same test, just in different symbols. You can compare the thermal energy of the system to the Fermi temperature. The Fermi temperature is just the Fermi energy divided by Boltzmann's constant K sub B. So if you're dealing with, for example, copper at room temperature, then KBT is about 1/40th of an electron volt. And I just calculated the Fermi energy. So if you plug in the values appropriate for copper and divide by Boltzmann constant, you will get something on the order of 11,000. And sure enough, 11,000 Kelvin is a lot bigger than room temperature, 300 Kelvin. And so that tells you that the electrons in copper are not only a Fermi gas, they're a degenerate Fermi gas. They're a cold Fermi gas. And the last thing we'll do today, which you need actually for the homework, is to calculate the degeneracy pressure. So for any gas, a gas of helium atoms in a box or a gas of electrons in a crystal, the pressure is the negative derivative of the internal energy with respect to the volume, and then holding the entropy and the number of particles fixed. So we have an expression for U right here, written on the previous page. There is no entropy in this expression. There's an N that occurs in two places. There's one and there's another one. So hold that N fixed and take the derivative of this expression for U with respect to volume. And again, that's, now this is not calc 2. This is even easier. This is calc 1. And after lots of algebra, you'll clean it up. Again, pull out a factor of the Fermi energy just for convenience. Instead of writing this bunch of symbols, it's just more convenient to write that as the Fermi energy. And then what you find is the pressure is positive 2/5 times the number of particles times the Fermi energy over the volume. But 3/5 of NE Fermi is U. So if I divide top and bottom by 3, then the pressure is 2/3 U over V, and U is extensive and V, the volume, is extensive. And so this is the energy density. Lowercase u is an intensive quantity called the energy density. And what you're seeing is the same result that you would have gotten for a box of helium. You can try this using the ideal gas law, and you'll see that for helium, the pressure is 2/3 times the energy density. So we're getting that same result for electrons and copper. That's indicating that they are non-relativistic. If you go through and calculate everything that we did in this lecture, but do it for photons, do it for massless photons, which are necessarily moving at the speed of light and are therefore always relativistic, you will find the pressure is not 2/3 times the energy density, but 1/3 times the energy density. So when you see the 1/3 in front, that should make you think relativistic particles. And when you see the 2/3 in front, you should think non-relativistic particles. And done.